Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 26th, 2008, and this is show number 175. So we have the biggest chat room audience of all time in the show today. So this is a lot of fun. Got a big party going on in here. And one of the things I think may have helped is that we're actually in two different time change things going on here. The rest of the world has already switched over to daylight savings time, or is it off of daylight savings time? But in the U.S., we're doing it 2 weeks off of the rest of the world on purpose to be as annoying as possible, evidently. So I've been saying over and over again, GMT minus 8, 5 p.m., GMT minus 8, 5 p.m. Yeah, be there. It's wonderful. Except now I'm GMT minus 7. So the good news is that means the Europeans are still awake. So that's kind of fun. So we got a lot of participation there. Willie's saying, yay us in the chat room. Oh, it's a lot of fun in here. If you get a chance, head on over to ustream.tv/nosilicast and look it up. Some vague time Sunday night, PST, 5 p.m. That's a way to say it. Anyway, we've got a really full show today. We've got a hot tip on RAM pricing, three dumb questions, a cool website resource, a Windows tip, an interview with two of my blind friends, an interview of a guy who's on the beta test team for Apple on accessibility, and in chit-chat across the pond, we're going to cover a Windows vulnerability in our Security Lite series, and we're going to talk about how much fun Bart and I have with our routers. We better dig in. Big show. All right, Tim from Palm Beach wrote in with some cool information I did not know about. During the Mac Roundtable, Victor Cahiao and I debated the advice we should give people about buying the new Macs, whether to buy them maxed out from Apple, or if they should buy them with less RAM and disk, and then buy the better RAM disk, cheaper RAM disk, I should say, from a third party. We normally agree on this, and that's to buy low from Apple and then do the upgrade. However, during the show, I did some quick research, and I found that on the MacBook Pros, and I'm only saying on that, I think on the Mac Pros it's totally not true, but I found that the price would be just about the same to max out the MacBook Pros to 4 gig, the lower-end MacBook Pro, and to upgrade the disk from 250 to 320. For once, Apple is not screwing you when you buy the maximum RAM for them. So anyway, I mentioned my favorite site for RAM, and I think a lot of people feel that way, and disk upgrades, is Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. And that's where I did the comparison. But Tim from Palm Beach, Florida, wrote in with some additional information on the topic. Here's what he wrote in his note. One comment on the discussion you and I believe Victor were having over memory upgrades at OWC. OWC's price is $139, but they also have a memory buyback option, which adds to their deal. They offer, not much, $15 for the 2 gig that comes in a MacBook Pro. So the final price through OWC would be $124 versus Apple's $150 to upgrade from 2 to 4 gig. Not a huge difference, but maybe other people do not know that OWC will buy back the original memory, which would otherwise sit in a drawer forever. Keep up the great shows. Well, thanks, Tim. I did not know that. I've been going to them forever and never once noticed that. Hey, $15 is $15. Think of all the times you just threw it in a box, your memory in a box, not $15, but your memory in a box, hoping somebody would need it someday. This is a much better way to go.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Ian sent along a dumb question. He said, I use Time Machine and Carbon Copy Cloner for routine backups. Now I'm looking for a way to back up my photos to DVD for offsite storage. I have pictures in both iPhoto and Aperture, and my libraries are 12 gig and 9 gig. Since they're both too large for a DVD, can I easily back up these libraries to multiple DVDs? He says, thanks for the great information and entertainment over the years. Cheers and happy feet, Ian. I love the happy feet line, Ian. That's great. But let's get down to business. I really think your best bet on backing up your photos for offsite storage would actually be to copy the libraries to an external drive rather than DVDs. With DVDs, you'd have to figure out how to split the libraries across the DVDs because of the size. Drives are so cheap now, you could buy two small drives. The cheapest ones you can find would be way too big. Drop your libraries onto one drive, put it offsite. Then when you want to update it, put your photos on the second drive and then just swap them. Another option would be to store them in the cloud. There's a bunch of services up there that would give you around 2 gig for free, but then you have to pay for enough to cover what you've got. This would be an easier solution than going back and forth with your drives, and might be even a little bit less expensive than the two-drive solution. The downside is how long the initial backup would take up over the intertubes. Well, now, keep in mind that both libraries, one thing I want to make sure you understood was both libraries, which look like one big consolidated lump, are actually packages that you can open by right-clicking on them and selecting Open Package Contents. That means you can navigate into them and see each individual photo in case of a problem somewhere down the line. I don't know how many people told me that, but I know Bart was one of the people. But that's important because that means even if you just throw them on a drive, you could still get to them later and look at individual photos, pull back one that you screwed up or something like that. All right, now I'm actually going to answer the question you actually asked. On the Apple discussion boards, I did find a description of how to back up your iPhoto library to multiple DVDs if you're still intent on giving it a shot. I put a link in the show notes to that discussion. I kind of stopped there. I didn't go looking for one for Aperture, but if there's one for iPhoto, there's probably one for Aperture. Personally, I don't like burning DVDs. That's going to take forever, and you're going to have to do it every time. So use one of those solutions. Next up, we have two dumb questions in one. BJ sent in his question over in Facebook. So now we've got, they're coming in like crazy over Facebook. Kind of fun to get them that way. Here's BJ's first question. I want to use GarageBand to do podcasting, but unfortunately, I have to reset levels every single time I start a new file, for example, for a new episode. Is there a way to create a template of some sort, a la WordPress or Microsoft Word or Pages, where the levels are in the same page, same place every single time? Or am I totally SOL? Well, when I first wrote back to BJ, I told him I would also like to have a template file, but I didn't have any way to do it that I knew of. I don't have trouble with my levels, but I do have to remember to set the input to mono and to hide the podcast track every single time. So it'd be a swell solution to be able to save a couple of clicks a week. And, you know, sometimes I forget, and then the audio sounds really, really bad when I do it that way. I suggested that we just create a GarageBand file with it set to the way we want it and save it under the name template. Then every episode, open it up, try to remember to do a save as first thing. Of course, you know, BJ would probably remember every time to do the save as, but you know I would probably forget at least once a month, cause myself more work than ever by doing it that way, and I'd be writing over the template file, have to recreate it, blah, 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 blah. So then I found an enhancement to my solution. I found a blog called Getting More Out of GarageBand over at mjewing.co.uk, where the author suggested doing exactly what I had said, but he added one more thing. They said, open the get info on that template file and lock it. That means you can't possibly overwrite the file because you don't have privileges. I tested it and it worked great. In fact, I'm using it right now to make this recording. I started with the template file and sure enough, I tried to save over it and forgot to do the save as, but it didn't let me. So I was able to prompt it with a new date and time. So thanks for the great question, BJ. You solved a problem for me too. BJ's second question was a bit more off the beaten path, but I found the answer to that one too. He asked, the other dumb question I have is related to iTunes 8, which I've been using pretty much every day since it came out last month. The question is this, is there some way to bring back a favorite setting of mine, which was in the store preferences, where it had a checkbox you could tick to say, load complete preview before playing on the iTunes store? This is a godsend for me personally because I have eternally slow connections. Did it move? Or more likely, did Apple decide we no longer needed that particular feature out of spite? Well, BJ, I don't know if they did it out of spite or not, but I did find a way to get back the functionality Apple took away from us. Over at the Mac OS X Hints blog at Macworld, Rob Griffiths laments the loss of Load Complete Preview, along with three other functions they removed. Show genre when browsing, show links to the iTunes Store, and play songs by while importing or converting. Rob doesn't just lament this loss, though. He gives us terminal commands to get the functionality back. Well, I don't want to snake another guy's work, so instead of putting the command on my site, I put a link in the show notes to the article so you can walk through the steps yourself. Don't be daunted at thinking of the terminal and going in there being really scary. All you have to do is launch terminal, type in this one-line command, and you're done. Not scary at all. Problem solved. My friend Bala turned me onto an interesting site. It's called eHow, and their tagline is how to do just about everything. He found it because he was trying to figure out how to do something in Excel, but then he noticed how many other things are on this site. The categories on eHow include arts, business, careers, cars, computers, culture, education, electronics, fashion. The list goes on and on. I noticed that there's a thing on how to treat fall allergies naturally. Hey, I could use that. Turns out eHow is user-contributed content, so it's as broad as you can possibly imagine. I mean, anything you can't figure out how to do, you might want to go check out eHow.com. Did you know there's a lot of uses for vanilla extract, by the way? All right, so I believe I've mentioned about 263 times that I was forced to use Windows at work starting around January of this year. It hasn't been nearly as bad as I thought, but there's been one thing bugging the daylights out of me. And I just figured out how to fix it. On the Mac, to do things like copy and paste, you use the Command key. That's that squirrely little key to the left of the spacebar. On Windows, you use the Control key. It's not that I can't switch back and forth between the two with ease. I mean, I have a little bit of stumbling when I first get home and when I first get to work. But it's just that the Control key is so far away from the keys you have to combine it with. I mean, try to go from Control up to T on my laptop, and it's for a new tab in Firefox. It's just way too far. It stretches and it hurts. It's a really unnatural angle. So that got me to thinking, what if I could remap the keys in Windows so that instead of using the Control key, I could use the Alt key? Because the Alt key sits right where the Command key is on the Mac keyboard, next to the spacebar on the left-hand side. Then I could use the same keystroke on both machines and not have that unnatural stretch from the Control key. I started hunting around for solutions and I found a free utility called KeyTweak from Crumsic. That's a big long URL, but ends in Crumsic, whatever that is. But I put the link in the show notes as always. Well, KeyTweak can probably do a lot of cool things, but all I used it for was to declare the Alt key to be a second, or I guess it's really a third, Control key. When you download KeyTweak, you'll notice it only says it works on Windows 2000 and XP, but it worked great for me on Vista. I am so happy I did this. Every time I hit the Alt key, I smile at how well it works now. That is, until it comes time to do a Control-Alt-Delete, and it doesn't work, because now I'm giving it a Control-Control-Delete instead of Control-Alt-Delete. So I have to retrain my brain to use the right-hand Alt key, which is to the right of the spacebar. But you know what that means? It's a really unnatural keystroke to do Control-Alt-Delete now. But that's a small price to pay. You think I wouldn't have to Control-Alt-Delete that often, but it still comes in pretty handy, I'm afraid. Like Friday when I had to kill IE7 because it locked up, and again when Twirl decided to hide itself, but it was still running. Oh well, I'm delighted with my newly transformed Alt key. I've been getting a lot of great feedback from people who've bought ScreenSteps recently. They're really excited about it. Now, most of these people used the free trial software first to make sure it was as cool as I said it is. Now, my feelings aren't hurt at all that they didn't just believe me. Really, really, I'm fine. It's okay. Just prove it to yourself. Well, the good news is these people are now much more productive. If you haven't heard me sing the virtues of ScreenSteps before, it's a fantastic tool for creating documentation of how to do things in Windows and OS X. If you're the kind of person who enjoys teaching people how to do things, but you're sick and tired of fighting with Microsoft Word and creating documentation, fighting it every step of the way, trying to make your text and screenshots look good in a document, then you are going to love ScreenSteps. This tool takes the burden away from you of any kind of formatting. You concentrate on creating good content. Spend your time wording the instructions, taking meaningful screen snapshots, and annotating them to highlight the important points, even showing drop-down menus to explain each step. Then simply click on Export, send your lesson to ScreenSteps Live online, send it to your blog, upload it to a wiki, or even create a PDF file to mail to someone. This tool is so flexible, it's hard to find something it can't do to increase the amount of time you feel happy and productive versus the agony of wasting your time fighting with formatting. That is not value-added work. Don't do it. If you don't believe me, I know it's better to see for yourself, so head over to screensteps.com and watch the short videos. Then download the free 30-day trial. Then, like everyone else who tries it, go back and buy it. And be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off of your purchase. I have a couple of really special things for the show today. This week, I had the pleasure of meeting up with Michael Gorman, who is partially sighted, and his girlfriend Maureen Schultz, who is completely blind. They spent some time with me discussing accessibility for the blind, and it was really enlightening. After that, we went to the exhibit hall over at the California Council for the Blind convention. I didn't catch it in the interview, but the CCOB's mission since 1934 has been to gain full independence and equality of opportunity for all blind and visually impaired Californians. I really enjoyed talking to Michael and Maureen, so let's give you a little bit of what we talked about. I am sitting right now with Michael Gorman, a continuing contributor, I hope, to the show. And we've been in contact for years and years, and his girlfriend, Maureen Schultz. And
hello.
We're just having a cup of coffee. I have to admit, I am a day late. We had an appointment to have lunch today, and I showed up yesterday. I was a day early.
Yeah, you were a day early.
But anyway, we were just talking about accessibility, and you were talking, Maureen, about what this has meant for you.
I was saying how nice it is to hear a podcast that does take all that screen reader access stuff that most sighted people, frankly, my dear, don't give a damn. As far as the market is concerned, we're a very small segment, very, very small segment.
And most of the equipment is obviously very expensive, too.
Yeah,
I think part of that problem is because the blind are a small minority, the price goes up. But as our population is aging rapidly, right, we're living longer and longer and longer. I mean, I'm almost assuming I will have macular degeneration at some time because, you know, I'm only 50, so I will probably live long enough to go blind.
Yeah, and I was saying to Mike, you know, she's not just like, a little bit for the blind, because many people have kind of a weird vision of what a disabled person, like, all of a sudden they're not normal people, you know, we're just normal people who happen to have a disability, right? No, Mike, she really wants to know. She's really into the details of this stuff. It's kind of amazing, you know?
So what have you learned at the expo here? What's cool?
Well, just general looking around, some interesting stuff. For instance, the first standalone GPS unit.
For accessible standalone.
Especially for blind people. There isn't even a display on it, I don't think.
Unfortunately, they won't let us take us outside to see it. Yeah.
Oh, and it doesn't work inside.
It doesn't work inside, yeah.
So it might be working.
I turned it on and just said, you know, no GPS location.
You still were paying about $900 for this.
Yeah.
But it is a GPS unit, standalone. And so that was just Trekker Breeze.
Yeah.
There are some developments there of little mini readers where you can download books from our library system that is especially for blind people. So this is only accessible to blind people. You know, the idea of carrying this little small thing and having about 100 books on it is kind of cool.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, my mom still uses the great big tapes and carries this big tape recorder around.
The talking books.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's going to change very soon. They have developed a format called DAISY. That's proprietary to blind people also. And because obviously, you know, they can't use MP3 for, you know, since it's all copyrighted stuff and don't want everybody else to access
it. Okay. I was going to say, why would you?
So there's big issues.
Proprietary anyway, because even the talking book machines have a flow speed that most tape recorders don't even play. So they can put more on the tape.
Yeah,
if you try to play a talking book tape on a regular machine, it'll go fast and you'll hear both tracks.
Oh, I always wonder why.
Going backwards and forward, it won't, you know, it'll sound totally awkward.
Yeah, so a talking book read on cassette, you get now 6 hours worth onto a cassette. But now with this new DAISY format, your book is basically even more powerful than an MP3 CD.
Oh, so it's a good compression and that sort of thing.
Very good, yeah.
And that'd be easier for them to send, too.
And you can navigate in it. So you don't, with a cassette, you can't do anything. You can't just find a place, you know, on cassette 24, somewhere in the middle of side one.
No, it does have the mechanical inefficiencies that are excellent, right? Because you pull the tape out, you put it back in, it's right where you left it,
That's
right?
the only good, yeah, that's true.
I still think, for older people, the transition might be a little hard. You know, it's a completely different market when you're dealing with blindness due to age than when you're dealing with blindness from birth. It's a completely different animal. I mean, the requirements are completely different.
So if you're blind from birth, you're more likely to be able to adapt?
Because you're doing
that's
all
true.
The... You're used to...
It's like your first language.
Being blind is normal to me. So any kind of technology is totally part of our life. I mean, I live with computers every day. That's how my life functions, basically. You know, you learn to do things blind that sighted people would say, how is that possible that she cooks? How is it possible that you, you know what I'm saying?
I'm kind of in the awkward situation because I was born totally blind.
Oh.
And had surgery when I was about 2 because I had cataracts.
Uh-huh.
So I'm considered partially blind, considered a high partial, which means I see very well, but still not well enough to drive a car or read small print. you get the attitude of people saying, well, you can't really, you know,
you're
can see.
You can see.
Yeah, I had that happen once.
Oh, my mom.
Many times.
My mom had that happen. She got on the bus and she wanted to pay the blind fare, and the bus driver said, well, you don't look blind.
Yeah.
And she said, well, would you like me to shuffle a little bit?
Yeah, right. It's always what you look like, and you know that really is so distorted.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you that much in that situation, but yeah.
So I'm in a world in a way that I've learned to use adaptive technology, though I've learned it later.
Mm-hmm. But for you, it's a second language,
but it's kind
of thing.
Second life, so it's still a little bit of learning too, just like it would be for a sighted person.
Yeah,
and then you use it as a supplement. I use it as
because
thing.
Yeah,
you have no other way of using it. You have to use it.
Right,
I have to use it.
Well, we rambled on for about another 28 minutes, but I decided to cut us off there. We talked for a bit about how the Apple II was an extremely accessible machine for the visually impaired, but then Apple essentially abandoned the blind when the Macintosh came out. Over the next two decades, developers worked on tools for the blind, but only on Windows, coming out with the great program JAWS. However, as we were to discover when we went into the exhibit hall and met up with Dave Wilkinson from HumanWare, Apple's most recent efforts are finally making some headway. Here's that discussion. Okay, we've moved into the Disability Center here. We've got a guy that's got a Braille keyboard and a display hooked up to a Mac.
Right, I'm using a Braille Connect 40-cell Braille display connected to a Mac through USB. And what's nice about the accessibility features of the Mac is that with OS 10.5 with Leopard, you have accessibility right out of the box. You can go to any Circuit City or any Apple retail outlet and plug a Braille display into your Mac, and you would instantly have speech in Braille. I was able to take the Mac out of the box and make it work with no sighted assistance, and the Mac had never been turned on before.
Wow.
That a PC can't do.
No, it absolutely cannot.
But the
root level of accessibility that you get on a Mac is fabulous. Where the Mac and the PC differ somewhat, Apple has only really been working with trying to make their computers accessible to the blind and visually impaired for the last two or three years, starting with OS X with Tiger. They've made tremendous strides in that time. But I think realistically at this point, if you compare the Mac with the level of access that you have to a PC for a blind person, there's still significantly more access to a PC. One, there's more software available.
So things like JAWS?
Screen readers like JAWS would be the equivalent of VoiceOver on the Mac.
Okay.
It's the same basic idea. It's putting speech, it's putting Braille at the ears and at the fingertips of the blind user. The easy part is to make it talk. The hard part is to make it say what you want to hear.
Are they working on the accessibility? Who's working on that?
Apple has a very active accessibility project.
Blind people on it?
There are blind people on it. I'm on the beta team for it.
Oh, okay.
So it is a very active project. And Apple is very committed to making the Mac accessible, not only to people who are blind, but there are low vision features. There are features for people who are deaf where you can have the screen flash at you at different times when the Mac would otherwise make noise. So it goes beyond just the blindness low vision side of things.
Wow, we should make sure you do get a plug-in. You're from HumanWare?
Yes, HumanWare USA. We are the U.S. distributor for the Braille Connect and the Braille displays, the makers of the Braille Note, the Stream, accessible GPS products like the Trekker and the Breeze. I could go on and make this a huge infomercial, but I'll stop at this point.
Well, make sure you give me your card when we're done so I can put some links in my show notes so people can find what you're talking about.
Sure, that'd be great.
Now, the initial question that Maureen asked was, does the screen reader, does VoiceOver from the from Apple, how does that compare to JAWS? And you said comparison.
I don't think there's I don't. For what it does, VoiceOver does very well, but the level of access that you have, at least in when I've been using it, using something like Safari versus using something like Firefox or Internet Explorer in the PC side, I have significantly more access to different parts of the web page using the PC platform. I've got things that are called quick key navigation where I can automatically do things like, say, jump to a button or jump to a form field, which I can't do on the Mac.
So that's great to have you on that beta team, though, then, because you can say, well, these are things that I really use all the time. Let's get those kinds of things into the products.
Sure. And frankly, there are other blind computer users that are on the beta team who are much more power users of computer, or better power users of computers, who are making that point probably
good.
A bit more articulately than me. But it is definitely being made, and Apple is aware of it.
Do you have the tracker here?
I do have the tracker here.
Okay, let me go ahead and cut this off.
Sure.
Very, very nice to talk to you. What was your name?
My name is Dave Wilkinson.
Dave Wilkinson. I'm Allison Sheridan.
It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Well, I had such a good time. Like I said, this whole event, it was very eye-opening, very interesting, and Michael and Maureen are both really nice people, and I just really, really enjoyed myself. It was great. I put links in the show notes to both HumanWear at humanwear.com and the California Council for the Blind. I put a picture of Maureen, Michael, and I, along with a picture of that fascinating Braille display the guy was talking about from HumanWear. I really enjoyed talking to him. That was Dave Wilkinson, by the way. And he did a great job of explaining the product. Hope you enjoyed this little peek into the world of blind computing, and hope you keep those with disability in mind when you're designing your own products and making your own content. Don't leave anybody out. We can't afford to lose any customers, you know? You know, there's so much to like about Honda Bob. He's reliable. He's funny. He's good at his job. He doesn't charge an arm and a leg, and your car will actually work perfectly when he's done working on it. Even your driveway will be clean. You won't be stressed out. You'll have been relaxing in your easy chair watching the ball game or enjoying gardening or, heck, even working for a living while he takes care of your car. Or upstairs playing on Uvu like Michael King. It's one of the very few stress-free services I've come across in the last 20 to 30 years. There are two requirements, but they're not all that hard to fill. You have to move to Los Angeles or Orange County, California, and you have to drive an Acura or Honda. That's not that hard, is it? I mean, if I can do it, anyone can. Wouldn't you love it if he drove to your house and took care of your car while you goofed off? Well, if you'd like to have Honda Bob make your life a little more stress-free, give him a call at 562-531-2321, or heck, shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. Don't forget to check out his fantastic website at hdabob.com. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with the hiccuping Bart Bouchats from BartB.ie.
And coughing and spluttering and generally unwell, Bart B. I've picked up a nasty cold, and whenever I cough, I end up giving myself the hiccups. I have no idea why that happens, but it does.
I like the way it makes you sound like you're in about second grade when you do your hiccups, because they're real high-pitched.
Oh, this could be a long show. Anyway.
Oh, I think it will. Well, let's go ahead and get started, Bart. So our topic, one of our two topics today was actually a Windows Security Lite segment. Why don't you start that off?
Yeah, well, you know, since we have an ever so slight Macintosh bias, I thought it might be nice for me for the first time ever to talk about security that's nothing to do with the Mac. mostly nothing. This Windows, Microsoft in general, are really reliable when it comes to security because their mindset is on large corporate organizations and corporate IT. So they give out their patches the same day every month. It's the second Tuesday of the month. It's called Patch Tuesday. And a week beforehand, so on the first Tuesday of every month, they tell you what's coming. So they say, like, next Tuesday we're going to have four Windows updates. They're going to be of this importance, one update of Office, and whatever else they may happen to give out. You know, they tell you how critical it is and when it's going to happen, etc. So you always know what's coming, and it's really nice. But when something really bad happens, they do what's called an out-of-band patch. And this only happens for really important stuff. And this happened this week. So they've released an advisory on Wednesday, and on Thursday they spat out the actual patch, and they gave it the rating of critical, which is the highest rating. Yeah, it's the highest rating, and they reserve that rating for a very special kind of flaw. It's the kind of flaw that makes a worm possible. In other words, the kind of flaw that you don't have to do anything other than plug your machine into the network to get hit.
Oh, I hate that kind. So nothing to do with your personal behavior, just and that's hard enough to control. This is nothing. You don't have to click on a link in a website or in an email or visit a porn site or anything to get it?
Absolutely nothing. Oh. You plug in that little network cable or turn on your Wi-Fi, and that's it. You're vulnerable. Which is why they're so critical and why Microsoft patched them so quickly and why they weren't going to wait until the second Tuesday of November to put this out.
Oh, yikes.
So it has been released. There's no worm targeting it yet, but right now all of the bad guys all around the planet are frantically reverse engineering Microsoft patch. And once they do that and they know how to make the bad stuff happen, I expect we'll see many viruses abusing this. Yeah. So this really reminds me, this is exactly the same type of flaw in exactly the same part of Windows that made Blaster possible. It's in a process called Windows Server, or the Server Service, sorry, which runs as System, which on Windows is the same as Root on Unix or OS X. In other words, this process has the power to do anything, and the bad guys get complete control of this process.
Oh, yikes.
So, yeah.
Is there a worm already, or?
Not that we're aware of, but what's interesting about this one, it was a zero-day vulnerability, which means that the first time anyone knew there was a problem was when someone saw hackers using it in the wild.
Yeah,
so this came to Microsoft's attention when they were investigating hacks and how those hacks worked, and they realized, uh-oh, we have a major flaw in this process.
Well, that's good,
which they
though.
Then fixed.
They discovered it on their own. That's really good.
Yeah, but it was discovered after people were getting hacked by it, which is really bad. So it's a scary one in many levels.
Okay. You were talking before we got on the air about this being a wormable thing, that there isn't a worm
yes.
yet?
There's no worm yet. It was being used for a hack, but no worm.
Okay.
So a worm is just basically, once a worm gets into your network, it just takes over every machine, which then takes over every other machine it can reach. So a worm just spreads like wildfire. So that's not happening, but targeted attacks where a bad guy was using it to get in and take over a system. That has been seen to happen.
Now, there used to be worms years ago. What was that really big one?
Blaster, MS Blaster. That was the biggest, I think.
Right. Now, that still lives literally in the veins of the interwebs, right? I mean, it's out there. If you plug an unprotected, like a Service Pack 1 or pre-Service Pack 1, I think it is, XP machine onto the network without a router, it would get infected immediately.
Pretty much, actually, yeah. I think someone measured it. It's like a minute or two. I know for a fact, from nasty experience, it takes longer to download the patch from Microsoft than it does to get infected if you're on dial-up.
Jeez.
Because I had to do this for my parents.
Oh, yikes. That's
with
scary.
Blaster. Yeah. So this flaw is of that level of seriousness. There is no worm yet, but it's that dangerous. Hmm. The good news is that your router protects you because it works by the bad guy connecting to the Windows port on your machine. I think it's port 445 and 139. So if they can't connect to that, they can't attack you.
So if you have a network router, you have a NAT router, that means you don't have to patch?
Not quite. It means you can't be attacked from the internet, but if someone ever visits you who has been infected, then they could get you. Because your router wouldn't be between you and them anymore. So patch, 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 patch.
So if you don't have any friends, you're okay?
Yes, if you're a loner, you're perfectly fine. But no, I think something important to mention as well, because people forget that they have Windows machines, us Mac users in particular. If you have a VMware machine that you almost never fire up, or if you have a boot camp partition somewhere that you almost never use, now would be a really good time to fire them up and patch them before you forget.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, I've got some sleepers, I would call them, where I've even burned them off to a CD or a DVD where I'm just like, okay, maybe later I'll load that one back up. But that would be vulnerable immediately.
Yeah. So, you know, it's now that you think about it, now that it's in your head, now's the time to patch them all up. So just go to Windows Update and do what it says. And that's it. You're protected.
Well, that's a really good one. I like that, you know, we do have a significant audience that for reasons that are unknown to me, they still find this podcast interesting, even though they're on Windows. So I'm glad we could do a little public service there, too. Now, I asked you before we started talking that whether a vulnerability like this could happen to the Mac, and you said, yeah, it could, right?
Yeah, I mean, any service that listens on the network, if it has a flaw, it will give you something like this. So on the Mac, we have MDNS is one service which gives us Bonjour that has been shown to be vulnerable in the past. Now, Apple have patched it up, but this had issues in the past. We could have issues again. Something to bear in mind, though, is that on Unix systems, stuff that listens on the network tends not to be run as root because that's considered really dangerous and silly. But on Windows, they don't make that distinction, and they have the system process listening on the network, which is actually quite silly.
Okay, so we shouldn't be smug at all.
Oh, no.
No,
I think we've learned that lesson over the years. You know, there's plenty of flaws on the Mac. We've just been lucky never to be horribly, horribly hit. But the potential is there, and one of these days we're going to be on here talking about how it's finally happened. I hope it's a long way away, but I wouldn't dare be smug.
All right, that's great. So that's actually a good point for us to take a segue into talking about NAT routers. You had mentioned them earlier in the discussion here, and we wanted to talk a little bit about why you would want a router and what you look for in a router. The message group that I'm in, one of the message boards I'm on, has been starting a discussion about what do you look for in a router, and is there really any big difference between them? So we wanted to kind of walk into that, and maybe we can take turns here. I'll throw out the first thing you want a router for is to share your network connection. In my case, I wouldn't even think about buying a router that wasn't wireless to share wired connections and wireless connections around the house. So
Something I look for, which may not be something anyone else cares about, and you mentioned wireless there. In the past, you used to care about how many holes were in the back of it, so how many wires you could put into it. But maybe I'm one of those weird people who still cares about wires. A lot of people possibly don't anymore.
Yeah, you do need a couple, though. I mean, I would like one more than one.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
But I think they come with four, right? Strapped. I think they usually come with four in general.
I think so too, actually. I've never seen one with, it's either one or four. Anyway, so, you know, if you have like a network printer or something that you're going to keep downstairs or next to wherever your internet comes in, you'd want a cable for that. And then maybe if you had like a time machine or time capsule, time capsule, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
You might want one for that. And then what else might you want one for?
Well, actually, that brings up a good point. Part of what I wanted to talk about is what I've done with my network at home. I had a WRT54G from Linksys for years and years, and they fail after a while, and I just buy another one, slap it in. They don't seem to last a really long time, maybe a year, something like that. And I don't know what fails in them, but the last time there was actually smoke.
Okay, that's pretty serious fail.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious I didn't need to do any diagnostics at that point.
Yeah. I probably need to be careful what I say here. I'll touch some wood. But my WRTG54, whatever they are, I've had it for years.
No smoke. People had a lot of several failures with them, but no, they're not that expensive. Buy another one. But anyway, I didn't. We've had two computers in the house: my son's iMac and my husband's MacBook Air that could use the newer N speed. And I never let them have N because I couldn't have N because I had an older laptop. So it's good to be in control. So anyway, I got the new MacBook Pro last week, and that has N. So I went out and I bought an AirPort Extreme. And now the AirPort Extreme has have four ports in the back, and it has one USB port. So like you said, I could I was able to share a network printer or make my printer a network printer. So I plugged my new free HP C4480 into the back of that, free because Apple gives you 100% rebate on that. And so now I can print wirelessly from any of these three end computers. So I'm going to plug it in, and I'm unplugging the WRT54G, and I've got to do a bunch of network configuration junk to do that, when I realized that I really should daisy chain these two. So I've got the Linksys router, the G router, plugged into the cable modem. Then I used the AirPort Extreme. I took its WAN port, plugged it into the WRT54G, and that now gives me one huge advantage. That is that all the devices on my network that can only do G will only use G, and the ones that are on N can take the N router. The advantage is that the G devices will slow down the N devices if they're sharing the network at the same time.
Yeah, that's something I think people need to be aware of with wireless. And it's not just between G and N, but any wireless network, the entire network always slows down to the slowest connection. And the further you are away from the base station and the worse the signal gets, the slower the whole network has to go. So if you have one machine hiding away upstairs in the attic somewhere that is on your wireless network but it has very poor signal, it will determine the speed of your entire wireless network.
Right.
And
right.
Like you say, if you have G and N devices on the one network, your N devices become G devices, and then all the cool, shiny N goodness just disappears.
Now, so I've been assuming one thing that's only true right when it's accessing the network. Is that true? It's not by their very existence that they cause that?
If they're on the network, then the network will negotiate down to that level, yeah. Well, so if they're just connected, then...
Really? So I thought like my TiVo, I've got a TiVo Series 3 HD, and I've got a G USB wireless adapter on that. And I thought that it would be only when it accessed the network to go check and see if there's new content. So it only does that, you know, maybe three or four times a day. I was assuming that when it's not actively doing anything on the network that it wouldn't disrupt it.
I don't know exactly how the TiVo deals with this network, but my understanding is that once you're actually connected to the to a wireless network, then you're taking part in it. Because wireless networks are not like... wireless networks are broadcast networks, so every machine sees every packet on the network.
Oh, so maybe
so they're always actually taking part in the network.
Hmm.
Now, if the TiVo simply turns off the network interface while it's not doing anything, then obviously it ceases to take part.
Okay. Well, so like I've got a PowerBook G4 that's got a G card in it. Or cripes, it might even be a B. I don't know. But if I have that thing closed and it's off, it's obviously not using the network.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's if the, just the way I think of it, if the little icon is on your airport icon in your menu bar, then it's on the network and determining speed.
So I guess we would need to know how the TiVo does it. So I've got the TiVo on G, the PowerBook G4 is, would be on G if it's awake, the old MacBook Pro is on G, and then, I don't know if you guys remember, but quite a while ago, we set up Steve in a separate room with his G5 tower, which cannot take a wireless card. You can't put a wireless card in it, shockingly enough. So I bought the Buffalo Wireless Ethernet converter, which hardwires to the, it's like a little router. It hardwires to the G5, but then it's got an antenna that picks up the wireless G signal.
Yeah, it's like it's an adapter between the air and Ethernet.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like a wireless card that's not on the inside of the computer, it's on the outside of the computer. So
yeah, it's really cool technology.
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, they were, I don't know if they've settled this or not, but there was some dispute over whether they were using someone else's patented technology. So they stopped selling them for a while, but luckily I got one right before they stopped. And fabulous service, man. When I called those guys for some help, they were amazing. But so that's on G, and then separate from that, then I've got the new MacBook Pro, the MacBook Air, and the G and the iMac on the N network. So that's pretty cool.
Excellent. Yeah. So, but you have your brain is not working today. So I guess the key point is that the reason that you went to the bother of daisy chaining is precisely to segregate all of your G's on one network that can run at nice fast G speed. And then, nice fast N speed, and then another network for all of your old devices.
Right, right. And I did that once before with my, I had an AirPort Extreme back when the older TiVos could only do WEP. They could only do the WEP encryption. They couldn't do WPA. I wanted to make sure I had all my other devices on WPA. So I segregated the TiVo off on that separate little network.
Yeah, just one point on that. If you want to do that in an actually secure way, you actually need three routers in a Y configuration.
Oh, really?
And yeah, but to get into that now would be an entire show. So Steve Gibson explains it really well on Security Now. He has an entire episode dedicated to this Y setup.
Wow.
How it works, why it works, how you do it. And his show notes are actually searchable. So if you go to grc.com, and search the show notes, you'll get full instructions there. So he's done a really good show on that.
I do, but like transcribing his notes, the notes from the show, and it's fantastic because sometimes I just want to jump to that one part and go look at it again. I don't want to listen to the whole show again.
It's fantastic because you know that Steve mentioned something about whatever, and you just type it in and you find that it's brilliant.
That's a lot of work on somebody's part.
It's a listener who voluntarily does it. I think she's called Elaine. She gets a regular plug. I think I'm pretty sure she's called Elaine, and she always gets a thank you for transcribing the show notes. It's a fantastic thing she does.
That's quite a service, yeah.
It really is. So where were? Yes. So you have your two routers set up like that, which works very well for you.
Mm-hmm.
But what came up on your discussion group was, you know, what differentiates routers? What features might you be interested in?
Right.
So should I go through what I look for, or
sure.
Do you want to go first?
No, you go for it.
Okay. For me, it comes down to three things I care about, because routers are really similar these days. I have yet to come across one that doesn't do all the basics. So in one sense, you can't really go wrong. But on the other hand, there's a few little things that it makes life easier if the router will do them. One of the first ones, which might sound a bit strange at first, is the ability to specify static DHCP route leases. So that every time your MacBook Pro comes on, it always gets automatically given the same IP address, for example.
Now, you just called it static DHCP or DHCP.
DHCP.
Isn't static and DHCP as two? Those are opposites.
No. What you do with a static DHCP lease, what that means is that the machine is set up to get its information automatically from the router, but the router always gives it the same one.
But the D and
so it
DHCP
dynamically gets given
dynamic.
The same thing.
No, seems
this is important. Because then if you take this laptop somewhere else, you haven't hard-coded an IP address. So the laptop will then ask the other network, give me any IP address.
Oh.
So the laptop is dynamic, but every time you come home, it will be dynamically given the same thing.
Okay.
And the reason you want that is for port forwarding,
right?
Like you and I do for Skype.
Yeah, maybe explain real quickly what port forwarding is, because that's such a powerful thing, and the technology words around it are just so dreadfully complex, but it's really not that hard to follow if you explain
yeah.
it easily.
So we said that a NAT router is like a one-way valve, and if an incoming packet comes in that hasn't come from an outgoing connection, it has no idea what to do with it. It's like, don't know what to do with this, and it throws it away. What you can do with this port forwarding is you can say that if traffic comes in on this port, even if it was uninvited, pass it on to this inside machine here. So forward that port to here.
And that's really important in games. There's a lot of times where games need, in order to do interactive games, like playing World of Warcraft online where you're fighting somebody you know, you have to be able to open that port.
Yeah, gaming often requires you open up ports. And if you want Skype without a middleman, Skype is really fantastic protocol. It can do really weird stuff to get around firewalls and things. But when it does that, you end up with relays. And so you can end up with as many as four as what we... For some reason, we always end up with four when we do this without setting up our port forwarding.
Right.
But what myself and Alison have done is each of us have picked a random port and told Skype that that's the port we're using to port forward to it. And so when the two of us Skype to each other, there's no middle people at all. We have zero relays. We talk directly to each other because we both have this open port that lets us go clean through each other's NAT routers into each other's machines for Skype.
Yeah, that has made all the difference in how often we talk over each other. Now we only do it about, 20-30% of the time?
Well, our latency used to be really high, and it's now our round trip time is now 200 milliseconds. It's a little on the high side. They say that you should be about 180 to never step on each other. So we're now on 220. But considering we're going the entire way across the Atlantic, we're okay.
We were seeing a minute and a half at one point, I think. But
it wasn't a minute. It wasn't a minute and a half. It was a second and a half, though, which is far too much.
Yeah,
far too much.
That was nasty. So
that's one of my big checklists is the ability to set up the oxymoronic sounding static dynamic leases.
Now, is that commonly available? I've never looked for that.
It seems to be 50-50 from my utterly unscientific sampling.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll have to check and see if I've got that.
Yeah, my parents' router does it. My grandparents' router doesn't. My router does.
Okay.
That's my entire sample size. It doesn't really tell us very much.
I'm curious to see if the Airport Extreme has that.
I don't know. I've never owned an airport. I really should.
This is actually my first one I've ever bought for myself. I inherited my brother Kelly's, but I haven't used it for anything much. So I'm not going to touch it right now, though, because the only way to look at the Airport Extreme is through the software that comes with it. I can't just browse to it and look at it. I think I have to start configuring it, and I know I would lose my connection if I did that.
Yeah, probably not a good idea in the middle of a Skype call.
Probably not.
Then my number two thing that I want is a slightly strange one in some ways. There is a protocol that is used to automatically set up port forwarding without any interaction. It's called Universal Plug and Play. And many people would see UPnP as a feature. And so it makes gaming easier because you don't have to set up the port forwarding yourself. But the downside is that it means that any bit of malware that ever gets into your network can make a way in for itself. It could basically open up your entire network to all the bad guys out there, thereby completely neutralizing the effect of a NAT router.
So let me guess, UPnP, you want the ability to turn it
ruins.
Off.
Yeah, exactly. I want the ability to turn off UPnP. And I do.
That's an important one, definitely. In fact, I need to check the Airport Extreme on that one. Let me throw one in the middle here. One of the things I was really pleased with the Airport Extreme was the default condition was you had WPA encryption on to start with. And for those not familiar with all the different ways to do it, pick WPA because that's the strongest encryption out there right now for these routers.
Yeah, to put it into context, if you use WEP, your network can be cracked within 2 minutes, being conservative. Some people say 30 seconds, so I'm being conservative at 2 minutes.
Right.
WPA, make sure your passphrase is at least 20 characters long. Otherwise, you're pretty much as vulnerable. Yeah.
Aw, come on.
Yeah, it needs to be a passphrase, so a sentence, like the quick brown fox jumps over whatever.
With O's it should be a sentence, and semicolons and uppercase and lowercase. And
what I actually do is I have a text file that I keep on my thumb drive, which is 63 characters of random text, and I just copy and paste it in.
Okay, but what about the other people on your network? That is, you got a friend that comes over, it takes you 15 minutes?
Yeah, it's on a thumb drive. Well, no, it's on a thumb drive, so I just give them the thumb drive and say it's called WPA.txt, copy that in. It's really handy, just give them the thumb drive.
Makes me tired. What if you're not home and somebody else comes over? Then you don't have
it. If I'm not home, they shouldn't be on my network.
Well, what if Wing has a friend over? I mean, come on, that's too hard.
We both have the key on our machines. It's just a text file.
Too hard.
It's I like my security. I think, but no, if it's less than 20 characters, it's really not actually secure.
Mm. All right, well,
it's less insecure than WEP. Okay, but it's actually crackable within an hour or two.
As less insecure, meaning it's more secure than WEP.
Yeah, but I don't like to use the word more secure because it sounds good. Less insecure.
Crankpot.
Yeah, I know. the final thing on my list is I like the ability to be able to specify any DNS server I want. Rather than taking the DNS servers from my ISP, I like to be able to say, no, use OpenDNS, please.
Okay. I wonder if they all have that. I should check that, too.
They almost all do, unless there are a few UK ISPs that give you routers that stop you from doing it.
Well, in spite of our best efforts, Skype seems to keep hanging up on Bart and I here, but that actually is going to about wind up everything we wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It seems to be a recent thing in the past few weeks because we had it last week, we had it today, and we had it on IMP Live yesterday.
Oh, and so, we had it on the Mac Roundtable too.
Yeah, it seems that Skype has decided, maybe it's grown to the point where it can't handle itself anymore, but it just, yeah, it's really annoying. But anyway, we got our content in the end, so until next time, happy computing.
Well, after we got done recording, I thought it might be fun if you got a look at my network diagrams through the years. I have one from 2005, a year later in 2006, and then my latest setup for October of 2008. It's pretty fun to see how the network complexity has grown and how many things are in my house that require network skills to work. Well, it looks like we're going to have to call it a day again. I got to tell you, this is the most people we have ever had in the chat room. Somebody said that the NoSilicast live feed ended up on the front page or something. I asked him to shoot me a picture if it did. But we got a whole bunch of people in here. We got 64 people in here right now while I'm talking. This is really, really fun. Having a good time. Got people finding out about the show, so maybe I should tell them where to find the show. Let's see. Be sure to check out the Mac Roundtable, as always, over at macroundtable.com. I was on it a week ago, and that was a great time. We had a good time. Well, if you want to participate in the show, you should send in a dumb question. You know what I mean by dumb questions, by the way? It's a question that isn't actually dumb, but it seems dumb to you, so you're afraid to tell anybody about your question. They always end up helping somebody else. Heck, BJ's question helped me this week. If you want to send in a dumb question, you want to record a review, complain, compliment, or just chat, shoot me an email over at nosilicast@gmail.com. Be sure to follow my nonsense over on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.